From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we blow our tops with former volcanologist George Stone and learn a little about the workings of a volcano.
Rocks do not melt at a single temperature. Rocks, even the rocks down in the Earth's mantle, are a mixture of minerals. Each mineral is a specific compound with a specific melting point.
Then a Milwaukee researcher is exploring how motherhood has been used as a tool to influence public opinion.
A lot of women organized around the idea of motherhood, and they can see a commonality between their motherhood and the motherhood of women who were enslaved, who were trying to be mothers, and their children were taken away from them, or they didn't have the capability to be good mothers because they were enslaved.
SAS Kirsten Wisniewski relates a Mother's Day story encountered on a train in Wales.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, X-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Hawaii's Mount Kilauea is continuing to erupt, sending gas and molten lava from the earth. The lava has destroyed property and raised health concerns related to its poisonous gases. And then there are fears that the eruption may continue to get more violent in the coming days.
There is much that scientists understand about the mechanics of a volcano, but still plenty of answers yet to be found. We talk with George Stone every so often about his expertise on climate change. But before that work, George was an expert on the original global warming, volcanoes. And he joined us in the studio this week. He talked about his first up-close view of the volcanoes in Hawaii.
I was out there in 1966. The Geological Society of America's annual meeting that year was in San Francisco. I went out there. They had a field trip to the Hawaiian volcanoes, which I took, and it was just marvelous.
And love at first volcano.
Love at first volcano, right. You got to learn how to pronounce all those wonderful names.
Well, so let's talk about what's happening in Hawaii today. And the thing that first grabs you is this idea that scientists are seeing clues about eruptions that are about to happen before they happen. What are scientists seeing that gives them the inclination to believe that a volcano is about to erupt?
Well, there are three main measures. And let me point out the U.S. Geological Survey has a volcanic hazards program, and they have volcano observatories in various appropriate places, such as there's one in Vancouver, Washington, which monitors the Cascade volcano, such as Mount St. Helens, which blew up, as you know, in 1980. The Hawaiian Volcano Observatory is at Kilauea Volcano, and they monitor, as I said before, three principal things: earthquakes underneath the volcano, in some cases, tilt of the ground surface, something called a tilt meter, which simply, if the volcano is inflating, bulging out due to the insertion of magma underneath, the tilt meters will pick that up. And the other main measure is sulfur dioxide gas. That's one of the main gases that's given off by magma in volcanoes. And if magma is moving up underneath the volcano into the innards of the volcano, then the sulfur dioxide gas emissions increase dramatically. And of course, that's a dangerous gas because it dissolves in water to form sulfurous acid. With a little oxidation becomes sulfuric acid. And so that, I think, is probably the most deadly gas associated with the volcanic activity.
So let's talk about that first measure, the earthquake. And there was an earthquake that was recorded underneath Kilauea, correct?
Yes.
So is the earthquake coming as a result of the eruption that is starting, or is the earthquake the cause of the eruption?
Well, a little bit of both. There are two types of earthquakes associated with volcanic activity. One is as the magma begins to migrate upward, and we're talking about from a depth of maybe 50 or 60 kilometers, 30 miles, 40 miles, as the magma begins to migrate upward through cracks and through the rocks, it produces a kind of vibration called harmonic tremor. And harmonic tremor is a vibration. They are earthquakes, but they have particular signature, which is easily recognized. It's produced by moving magma. So they watch for that. Harmonic tremor means moving magma. Then there should be also an increase in sulfur dioxide. The other type of earthquake would be, there have been a lot of those associated with the current eruption, is when something mechanical happens within the crater. Maybe a big slab of rock suddenly moves, and that produces a sharp earthquake, quite different from the harmonic tremor.
And different from the movement of a tectonic plate.
Yes, much smaller scale.
So let me ask you. I mean, obviously, there is magma at this great depth, around the globe. Why is it that the magma is more likely to come to the surface through these volcanoes in some parts of the world than others?
Well, that's a great question. There are two principal kinds of locations for volcanic eruptions. One, as you mentioned earlier, is associated with tectonic plates. And where subduction is taking place and a big plate is moving down into the Earth's mantle. And let me clarify, the outermost layer of the solid Earth is the crust, and beneath that is the Earth's mantle, which is very thick all the way down to the core. And subduction involves the movement of a plate down into the mantle. And as it gets down into those higher temperatures, the lowest melting components of the rock begin to melt and magma begins to form. So a lot of volcanoes, such as the volcanoes along our west coast, the High Cascade volcanoes from Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen down in California all the way up through Crater Lake and Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier in Oregon and Washington. And these are explosive kind of volcanoes. They erupt in an explosive way because they have a much higher gas content.
As in the case of Mount St. Helens, they can blow the top off a mountain.
Exactly right. Whereas the other location, the other type of geologic locus for volcanoes is what's called a hotspot. And we've got two great examples of that in the United States, Hawaii National Park and Yellowstone National Park. Yellowstone is a hotspot underneath the continent, quite different and very much more explosive. Incredibly explosive. And then under the Pacific Plate, the Hawaiian hotspot, which produces magma from the mantle, which is a different kind of magma. It's basalt. It's that black lava rock that you've seen. And it's much more fluid, less viscous. It flows long distances on low gradients, whereas the much more silica-rich magma of the Yellowstone of the continents, it's like trying to squeeze oatmeal up through some cracks. It just doesn't move very well and produces explosive, plugs up its own plumbing system and produces explosive eruptions.
So in the case of the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii, obviously the time of the eruption is a time of danger for life and limb, both from the gas and the lava itself. Or the magma. Yeah, I guess it's lava as it's flowing. It's magma when it's under the underground.
Right.
But at the same time, what are the kinds of things that scientists have an opportunity to study when an eruption is going on like this, and in the wake of that eruption, when they go back and are able to analyze what happened?
Well, they very much like to analyze first the gas component that's released by the eruption. Also, the chemistry of the actual magma itself. It varies quite a bit, and it's characteristic of each volcano. For example, for a long time, Kilauea, which is kind of on the side of Mauna Loa, the big island of Hawaii, comprises one huge volcano, Mauna Loa, and which rises 29,000 feet above sea level and another 30,000 below sea level. So it's a huge mountain. Mauna Loa has been accumulating for millions of years. It's over what's called the Hawaiian hotspot. We're not quite sure what produces the Hawaiian hotspot, whether it's kind of leakage from the core, which is the outer core is liquid iron. It's extremely hot. Or some think that it's due to an accumulation of radioactive elements, which produce radiogenic heat, a lot of extra heat. But whatever the cause, whether it's leakage, a plume coming up from the core, or whether it's the local concentration of the radioactive elements in the mantle, there is a hot spot there. And the Pacific Plate, now that you mentioned plate tectonics, has been moving eastward. Actually, the Pacific plate moves westward, and the Hawaiian Islands move eastward. If you can imagine a candle and a piece of paper, and you move the piece of paper, get it just the right distance so that it begins to char from the heat of the candle. If you move that piece of paper slowly across the top of the candle, it produces a trace. And that's what the Hawaiian Islands are. They're a trace of the Hawaiian hotspot across the Central Pacific. And it's very long. It goes all the way to Midway Island and then turns north up into the Emperor Seamounts. And it's almost 4,000 kilometers long, this chain of volcanoes produced by the Pacific Plate moving slowly over the Hawaiian hotspot.
So do we have an opportunity with eruptions along the Hawaiian hotspot to trace, if you will, better what's causing it? You talked about the two potential causes for the Hawaiian hotspot. I imagine that's a question that scientists are still trying to work out.
Sure. Well, it's basically what's the heat source.
Right.
And one thing people should realize is that rocks do not melt at a single temperature. Rocks, even the rocks down in the Earth's mantle, are a mixture of minerals. Each mineral is a specific compound with a specific melting point. So a mixture of minerals melts over a range of temperature. And what forms the magma is the lowest melting or the first melting component. And then that is lower in density and due to gravity and buoyancy. Rises to the surface. So one can find trends, compositional characteristics, but it's very difficult to predict because, just like earthquakes, I mean, we don't have a network of sensors down in the mantle.
So when it comes to predicting the likelihood of an eruption, we're talking about, you know, hours or days as opposed to weeks or months.
Yeah, and it depends on the type of volcano. Now, Mount St. Helens, for example, which was an eruption, it was May 18th, 1980. That kind of eruption, the volcano had been swelling up for months. It started swelling up in March, inflating, and lots of little earthquakes down underneath, harmonic tremor and other earthquakes started in. And so the Cascade Volcano Observatory issued evacuation orders. They were right on. You know, that very few lives were lost as a result of that enormous explosive eruption. The other kind of volcanic eruption is non-explosive like Hawaii. It's usually called quiet and consists largely just of lava flows moving downslope and without any big explosions. So
And as far as being able to predict those?
Again, the earthquakes are the best clue as to what's going on down underground.
Well, George Stone, it's really interesting stuff, and I thank you for helping us add some context to it.
Thank you, Mitch. We don't have to worry about Hawaiian volcanoes here in Milwaukee, but we do have to worry about global warming. So study up. We're going to have to deal with this, and it's getting more and more urgent.
George Stone is a retired professor of natural sciences at the Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he's a Lake Effect contributor. You can find links to NPR's coverage of the Mount Kilauea eruption at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then a researcher explores the powerful rhetoric of mothers through the years. We'll find out what she's learned when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's Mother's Day weekend, and while it's a time we traditionally give thought to the influence our own mothers have had on our lives, a UW Milwaukee researcher is studying the broader impact of motherhood.
Leslie Harris is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at UW Milwaukee and president of the Organization for Research on Women and Communication. She joined us in the studio to talk about how motherhood has shaped our society. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what are the lenses through which motherhood shows up in your research?
Whenever you're looking at women in public culture and the ways in which women try to engage in public culture, you almost inevitably come across motherhood as a really important theme in things that you're seeing. So some people end up using motherhood as a resource for action. Sometimes motherhood is a necessary limitation to what people are doing. So why are you doing this if you're a mother? Or mothers can't do this sort of thing, or good mothers behave in this way. And sometimes motherhood is the site of things that people are trying to change.
Is motherhood ever used as kind of, to use a very modern term, street cred? I can do this because I am a mother, or these people can do this because they are mothers?
Yeah, there's a long history of women justifying public action because of motherhood. So even during the Revolutionary era in the United States, women's public identity was around this identity of mother, that they're supposed to raise good citizens in order to shape the new country. But then during the Civil War, women used motherhood as a justification for anti-slavery activism. Going into the 19th and 20th centuries, women have used motherhood as justification to act to prevent drunk driving, to reduce gun violence, all sorts of different public actions that might seem uncomfortable or even taboo become possible under this lens of motherhood. Because after all, what else are women supposed to do other than protect their kids?
Right. So I was going to ask, as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking of famous mothers throughout history, and thinking about the role of the First Lady. And in a lot of ways, it feels like we might think of her sometimes as not just the wife of the president, but as the first mother.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Women sometimes, especially public women, become emblematic of what people are supposed to do in the way that they're supposed to behave. So sometimes we follow the First Lady's lead in things that are acceptable behaviors or good behaviors. But sometimes First Ladies become targets of criticism because they're in such a prominent public position.
At what point do women learn that motherhood might give them access to public discourse and influence in public policy in a way that other aspects to their womanhood do not?
I think there are a few parts of it. The first is that not all biological mothers it's not only biological mothers that use motherhood as a tool for action. So a lot of people, especially women, can draw on this idea of motherhood in order to justify public action. So some of the most famous people during their time were active kind of as mothers, even though they weren't biological mothers. So if we look into like the 1880s and 1890s, Frances Willard was the most famous woman of her time, incredibly influential, and she ran the largest political women's organization in the country, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And she organized women around this banner of home protection. As mothers, women need to organize to protect their kids. And they even celebrated a Mother's Day in January during the winter in celebration of Frances Willard's own mother. So there is an example of women organizing even if they're around this idea of motherhood, even if they're not biological mothers. But right now we see a lot of women who notice problems in the world a new way because of their connection to their own motherhood and their relationship with their own children. And even talking to a lot of women, they don't see themselves as particularly political, but they know or they see one of their primary jobs as protecting their own kids and other people's kids. And that realization can become a moment of action for a lot of people.
This is the term that people have started using in the last 10, 15 years of the mama bear.
Yeah. And the mama bear, that language might be more recent, but it's an idea that has a really long history in the United States.
Well, so let's go back a long way, more than 150 years here, because you have written about the role of motherhood as it pertains to anti-slavery activism. How was motherhood a factor in making a difference in changing attitudes towards slavery?
Well, a lot of women, especially women in the North, may not have felt personally connected to slavery, but for many of them, they felt there was something wrong and they needed some way to act and a tool for action and a justification to act in a world where women were not really supposed to be public and political. And so a lot of women organized around the idea of motherhood, and they can see a commonality between their motherhood and the motherhood of women who were enslaved, who were trying to be mothers and their children were taken away from them or they didn't have the capability to be good mothers because they were enslaved. And so women in the North, primarily white women in the North, drew on this idea of motherhood to unify people to act, but to also create a sense of empathy and identification with women who seemed so different than themselves.
And they did this through magazines, I guess?
Yeah. One really common form was gift books. So the Liberty Bell is one gift book where authors and nonfiction, fiction, poetry would all be assembled in a book that was ultimately sold in order to promote the anti-slavery cause. And these would be like coffee table books. And some were sold at a higher price, some were sold at a lower price, and it disseminated this message. Sometimes these same messages were also in pamphlets. It might have been in popular literature during the time, published in magazines or newspapers as well.
Of course, at this point, women do not have the vote. And so the hope is that the women, by being united, would influence the men in their lives?
Absolutely. So the vote is just one form of public engagement. And in some ways, it's really important, right? But women didn't have the right to vote until 1920, at least all across the United States. And so the ability to harness language and rhetoric to influence public opinion and to change the shape of the public conversation was incredibly important, especially since they didn't have that institutional resource. But even after the vote, women's public influence was very much tied to their ability to harness language and rhetoric and shape the ability for us to talk about something in very specific ways. And that can extend an individual's power beyond that just one vote that they have.
What were some of the other key examples along the way of how the power of motherhood and the rhetoric of motherhood made a difference in public policy?
So the Women's Christian Temperance Union is probably the most significant example. Now, this was in the 1880s and 1890s, the single largest women's organization in the United States and probably the rest of the world as well. And here, women organized under this banner of temperance, keeping alcohol out of the home. And ultimately, they pushed for the Prohibition Amendment. But their idea was that they needed to organize to protect the home because there was significant problems with domestic abuse. Women didn't have control of their own property or money in the home. And so they felt that focusing on this issue could help them become better mothers and protect the home. And so motherhood became an organizing mechanism during that movement. But it also came up in peace movements. So Julia Ward Howe, for example, established the first or one of the first Mother's Days for Peace, which was an organized movement to promote world peace, an anti-war organization, but specifically focusing on the role that mothers had in maintaining peace under this assumption that women are peaceful, they're loving, and if you can harness that love, then everybody can get along.
Did the rhetoric of motherhood ever come into conflict with other women's issues? I mean, I'm thinking about the Equal Rights Amendments.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about the rhetoric of motherhood, we have a set of cultural expectations, and those cultural expectations are both limiting and empowering. So the idea that mothers nurture and care for children, that they're loving, that they can do it all, that they can be in every place and do everything really well, those are all limitations that individual women have to grapple with, but also that people use in public culture to suggest that women shouldn't be doing certain things. So women running for public office are often asked, well, who's watching your kids? And of course, in the debate over the ERA, there was a significant debate about whether women really needed this Equal Rights Amendment because women should be different. They should be honored. They should be separate. And they should really be focused on their kids. So motherhood is always a double-edged sword.
At some point, does the rhetoric become it's not either or, but, you know, this and that?
Yeah, I think this is a constant problem that we're trying to grapple with. So as long as we have these expectations about what it means to be a good mother, it's always going to be used as something that can limit women and used to judge women's proper performance. So are you good enough? And in reality, most people aren't. Nobody can ever meet all of those expectations. But at the same time, we always have the ability to use those expectations to harness power and to do things because of those expectations. So it's not a good or bad thing. It's something that exists in culture that can be limiting, but it can also be empowering.
And in the end, I imagine this interview does not replace the need that I have to call my mom.
Absolutely not. Call your mother.
Leslie Harris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Leslie Harris is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at UW-Milwaukee, and she's president of the Organization for Research on Women and Communication. You can read more about her research on motherhood at wuwm.com.
Lake Effect essayist Kirsten Wisniewski is a Milwaukee native who has been working in language and skills education in the U.S. and Europe for the past 5 years. She's perpetually confused for someone much younger, often being mistaken for a student herself.
Wisniewski is back to living stateside, but thinks frequently about the young people who've made an impact on her over the years, including one she met on a train.
I've spent much of the last several years living and working abroad, and last year at this time I was in Wales. Mother's Day in the UK is celebrated far earlier than it is here, though I still felt like a bad daughter spending American Mother's Day weekend in Cardiff with some friends. I was taking the train back to my Welsh home that Sunday, actual Mother's Day, and the cars were a hellscape of no seats. In the horrible bathroom area at the end of the wagon, there were a couple of fold-down spots. I sat in one, and the next was occupied by a very young woman wearing false eyelashes. One of them was starting to peel up in the corner, but they were applied far better than I ever hoped to be able to. As soon as the train started moving, she turned to ask me whether the next stop was Newport. I said that I think it is. She says she just got on the train that a station employee told her was right, but that she had no idea. She tells me that normally she's very nervous to ask people questions. She can't even ask for change in a shop. She asks where I'm getting off. I tell her Abergavenny. She is shocked by this, since Cardiff and Abergavenny are like a 50-minute train ride away, and she asks why I was in Cardiff. I tell her I was visiting friends, and she tells me I'm a very good friend for traveling so far. She asks me where I'm originally from. I tell her the U.S. She is floored. I ask her what she was doing in Cardiff. She tells me that she lives there. She's going to Newport for the afternoon since she just had to get out of Cardiff. She rapidly pours her heart out, telling me about the breakup that she's going through, the boy in question truly sounding awful. She tells me that even though they fought a lot, she loved him, saying it with earnest confidence that's unique to teenagers. She tells me that he cheated on her, and she took him back, but he did it again. I tell her that I think she can do better. She tells me that he threatens to kill himself when they fight, knowing full well that she had lost her mother to suicide only 2 months before. She doesn't cry when she says this, but this will be the only time in our conversation where her voice wavers. I tell her that I know that she can do better. She asks if I've ever had a boyfriend. I tell her that I've had several, that I'm actually older than she probably thinks, even though I have the face of a child. She asks me how old I am, saying she figured we were around the same age. I tell her I'm 27. She tells me she's 15. She seems to feel bad for thinking I was a kid, but I tell her that when I was teaching Austrians her age, some of them thought that I was a foreign exchange student. She laughs, then asks me why I like Wales better than America. I say that I don't always. But she says, but you do. Then the whirlwind of a conversation continues. She asks whether I have a family. She asks if I flew here on my own, if I moved to Austria on my own, whether it was hot in the U.S. As I respond to her question, she plays with the light blue ball of a tongue ring. She tells me that she would love having me as a teacher. She tells me that I'm brave. The details of her life keep tumbling out as our journey continues. She tells me about the friends she's visiting. She'll have to walk 3 miles from the station in Newport to her friend's house. She describes herself as not much of a walker. She tells me that she hates running, most of all. She ran a 5K recently as a charity fundraiser, and it was the worst day of her life. She says that it was for a children's hospital, and the only way she got through it was by thinking about her baby brother, who died when she was 9. It was easier to run if you were doing it for someone. She says maybe she'll get a bus in Newport. She's a pound short, but maybe she'll ask someone for change. But she can also walk. I'm the audience to a stream of thoughts delivered in the non-self-conscious way that teen girls normally reserve for close friends. I offer her a pound. She tries to refuse to take it, saying, I don't have to do that. I say that I know, that she didn't ask, that I'm giving it to her since I want to. I don't say that I want to give her the pound because every 15-year-old girl going through a hard time deserves even the littlest of breaks. That I hope that when I was 15, had I been having a rough time, someone would have tried to look out for me even just a little bit. That if I ever have a daughter, that someone kind on the train would chip in for her bus fare if she was alone and going through a lot. I don't say that I want to give her the pound because she's so, so young and seems so mixed up. She's sweet and earnest, and she reminds me of other young motherless girls her age I've taught over the years. Without fail, they have been strong young women asked by the world to deal with the very adult experience of the loss of a parent far too early. They are girls who have inspired me with their ability to cope and thrive, both becoming more independent and caring profoundly for those around them. But they are also girls I've wanted so badly to protect. As an adult woman in their lives, I've wanted to build the defense around them, shield them from a brutal reality that I have no power to keep out. They're not fragile. They haven't needed protecting. But nonetheless, I have wanted to keep them safe. I'm so proud of these girls, these young women, who in some ways are stronger and braver than I am. But I also hate that they have had to be. I don't tell her that back home, it's Mother's Day. The train pulls into the station in Newport. I give her a pound. I wish her luck, and she gets off the train.
Lake Effect essayist Kirsten Wisniewski is a Milwaukee native who now lives in Minnesota along the north shore of Lake Superior.
We'll take one last break and then have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Exfabula. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal story.
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for Exfabula Radio on 89.7 WUWM. We do this every weekend as part of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bruce Winter. Co-founder of Milwaukee Exfabula, Leah Delaney, is here every week bringing us stories from past story slams that we can enjoy on the radio. How are you doing?
Well, I'm glad that you're enjoying them. I am as well.
And it's Mother's Day weekend, so we'll have something for that too.
Yeah. We have a couple of things going on. We have actually an action-packed show. You know, for the past few weeks, we've been leading up to our All-Stars event, which is all of the audience favorites from season 9 jumping up on stage to tell a longer story. This time the theme is about connections. And so we've been featuring all these stories the past few weeks. Unfortunately, our last event in April, where the theme was Last Straw, the winner of that night, Eugene Pitchford's story, the audio did not turn out. And unfortunately, We can't air it due to the fact that we had some distortion issues.
Yeah, we couldn't fix it. We tried.
Right. You know, he was so awesome. He just blew that mic apart, basically, and just won. So if you want to see him, you have to get to the All-Stars event to see him in person, because he will knock your socks off as well.
How's that for a good tease to come to the All-Stars
right,
event?
Right, exactly. Yeah. We got some really great humdingers coming up on stage. But with that being said, we are going to start our show out with a Mother's Day story, and then we are going to end today's story with a gentleman who recently passed away that we were very saddened to hear, Shakespeare Lewis. So let's switch gears again. Let's jump back to our first story, Mother's Day. Here is Magda Peck, who told this story at our Perfect Storm event in 2016. Here's Magda.
It was about a little bit before noon on a Monday when I saw the text from Dilja. Four words: it's bad. Call me. See, Dilja has been spending 4 hours a day with my 91-year-old mom, who'd been living alone and independently and quite brilliantly for quite some time. And I knew this might be the stroke that she always wanted. And in fact, it was. By the time she got to the hospital after not being able to speak so clearly, she told Dilja, "This is the one. This is the one. Don't cry. We'll dance together." My mom's been living on her own for many years. She's quite the world traveler, but she ended up in Berkeley. And he had a stroke about a year ago, but it wasn't the kind that she really wanted, because it just meant she couldn't walk. But she did eventually get back home. And she did eventually start seeing patients again as a therapist at 91 in her front room. You don't know Thelma. And in fact, I called her every single day after the last stroke, and I went out to see her every month. And each time she'd sit me down and she'd say, "This is it. This is my directive. I want to die at home." So by the time I got to California, I had a very clear mission. I've been her wingman for a number of years, probably since I was 16, but that is another story. And I managed to convince the hospital that she should be able to come home to die, because it had blown everything out. The problem was that Kaiser, her main hospital, had transferred her to the most elegant hospital, much like Thelma's style, and had managed to get her to a place that was so beautiful, but it would not release her. It would not send her home unless she was stable, because they told me if she died in transport, they couldn't take the risk. And I said to him, "You do not want to send my mother home to die because she might die dying?" Now, this seemed crazy enough, but they basically said, if in fact she can be stable by the morning, then we can agree to let her have transport home. But you have to have a hospice nurse from the other system in her house waiting for her with a hospital bed, ready to accept her into hospice. Because you can't go into hospice if you're not alive, right? So if she died in transport, then I'd have to call the police. I sat there and I listened to all of them, this system, that system, and hearing my mother's voice. And I remembered I promised her, "I got this, Mom." So I crawled into bed with her that last night in the hospital. And I just said to her, "Hey, Ma, chill." No, not that much, but chill. Like, get your AFib under control, and by morning, if you're stable, maybe they'll let you go home. I promised you I would get you home. The next morning, her heart is like calm and chilled. The hospice nurse, the only one available in the North Berkeley area, was at the house waiting for her. My sister, thank God, got in the transport and kept her company, because I don't do that, I just give orders. And we got her home in time for my kids to fly in from around the country, for my husband to be at my back, for me to be her wingman one more time. And then we crawled into bed with her again, and I whispered in her ear, "Ma, we got this." And at the last sunset, she took her last breath and last beat. Daughtering is a full-time business, I'm going to still be her wingman. But you know what? I'm hoping that this time, maybe between 60 and my 90, maybe she'll be my wingman instead. Thank you.
And that was Magda Peck telling her Mother's Day story this weekend. Happy Mother's Day, everybody.
Very touching Mother's Day story,
yes.
Too. And yes, Mother's Day wishes to everybody, too.
Truly, truly. So, again, we are doing a special show today. Ex-Fabula was very saddened to hear this. One of Milwaukee's agent of changes, one of our heroes, Shakespeare Lewis, has passed away. He would have been 95, I believe, in June, in a month or so. But he played a huge role in the open housing marches in the 1960s. He was involved with the NAACP, the Youth Council, Commandos. And we were very fortunate, Ex-Fabula, to host him telling his story at one of our fellowships events, which plays in part to the open housing issues. The event itself was Race and Place. And he tells about a 9-minute story or so. So we're going to like cut it down a little bit, but you will be able to hear the entire story on WUWM's website.
Right.
Because we're going to air the whole thing there. So this is just a little bit of the touching story that we have here. Very powerful. And here is Shakespeare Lewis.
I can remember, I see a lot of people is not old enough, but I can remember when Black people didn't live north of North Avenue. And we know that wasn't right. Even if you could afford it to live north of North Avenue, the white man did not have to sell you his land, did rent you in his apartment because of the color of your skin or the way you acted or whatever. I remember all those days. And it had to start somewhere. This was not right. Open housing had to come. Open housing, fair housing, it had to start somewhere. So then that's where the Youth Council came in at. When we went back, we had to start deciding what to do. And to make a long story short, I got to kind of pieces them up to give you just to get y'all the ideas. When we did get to rolling, there's a couple of pictures I passed around. I was gonna pass around and show people, but you probably won't find me on there, but I'm right on the front line. I'm right on the front line. But these are just one of the marches. I marched for 3 years to the South Side for open houses because the South Side here was the most vulnerable of not mixing racial discrimination living together. They was the most vulnerable, so this is where we had to work. And at that time, in those days, the South Side was covered. It wasn't Latinos and stuff. Now it was Polish people. And they was naturally haters of Black people, if people know from way back. This is not my home, but I seen a need of something need to be done when I got here. I moved here in 1959. The good Lord spares me. I'll be 75 years old this coming June. And I have walked to the north side, and I look and see all the beautiful houses up and down the streets of Brown Deer and places like that. And people look out the window, oh, I wonder what he's walking up and down the street for. But I'm gathering at one time. I remember when you couldn't live out here. You couldn't live all out here. And I played a big part, just not only me, we, as commandos and youth councils, played a big part on you living out here. But they'll look at you like you are just a pile of nothing. You know what I'm saying? That hurts. That hurts me right here to know what I went through. Got my head beat for 3 years marching. Snow, rain, nothing stopped us because it had to be done. And there was a reason for all of this, you know? There was a reason for all of this. And it worked. If I would ask that young man right there, hey, do you ever believe that there was a time that you couldn't live where you wanted to here, even if you could afford it? He would probably say yeah, but experience, he would say no, because he's not old enough. It was designed to for your kids, my kids, and my kids' kids, that they would never know that they couldn't live wherever they wanted to in Milwaukee. I was at the table. I think it was 68. I mean, it brings my memory. My head is so cluttered with stuff. I can't remember just everything, but I remember this. I was there in Washington, D.C., when the Vice President of the United States, Hubert F. Humphrey, signed that bill. I was sitting right at the table. We traveled, setting up. There's a lot of places that people wanted to be. They wanted to be like us, so they would come and try to get our ideas. We was nonviolent, unless we was pursued, where we had to protect ourselves and the marchers. We took training. We didn't carry weapons, you know, like a lot of the other organizations did. But we can't win with no weapons. We ain't got no weapons. We ain't got no tanks, airplanes, you know, half tracks. We got to go to the man that's got them to win that. That's a revolution, and you can't win that. You know what I'm saying? You can't win that at all. So anytime I get to tell my story and tell my feelings and tell about these fellow friends of mine that was there, young man back there, he was right there with us. To tell it, I have to. Sometimes I get full and fill up because it was so tense. And when you're not getting recognized as something, but people go through February and they talk about who made it and who made this here, but they never come back down to the root of the problem. If you got a problem, you got to want it fixed, you got to go back to the root where it started at, you know what I'm saying? And I don't know if they know that these people just popped up, but they had a lot of things behind them. The youth council here in this town had a lot of pull with the black community. If we supported a candidate for politics, the town was behind us, the community was behind us because we made good choices. I was Bobby Kennedy. I was his bodyguard when he was here, when he campaigned for him. Marlo Thomas, she campaigned for him. I was her bodyguard. But they had their own private security, but when they come to the black community, that was our job. They was there, but it was our job to look out and get them back to where they're supposed to be while they're in the black community. This is the kind of organization we was. This is the kind of support we had. If they had to get to a speaking engagement, we seen that they got back there and got back to their hotels where they had their own security, which they had their own security all the time. But this was our role. Strong, powerful, and determined that nothing was going to stop us from getting open housing.
And that was Shakespeare Lewis, one of our great agents of change here in Milwaukee, telling his story. And again, that's just an excerpt from the entire story that he told. We are going to air the entire 9 minutes on WWM. So please go to the website to hear the entirety.
Right. The whole story is at WUWM.com.
That's right.
So what's coming up?
Oh, well, my goodness. This is it, babe. We are wrapping up season 9.
We're done, huh? Okay.
We're done. Clicker. No, we're never done. We're going to keep going. We're going to be rolling into season 10 in September. But before that, we have our All-Stars event that we are plugging crazily. That's going to be on May 18th. That's a Friday night at the Turner Hall Ballroom. We do recommend that you get your tickets via pre-sale. So please go to papstheater.org for that interesting information. And also, if you would like to be a part of our fantastic organization, if you would like your bragging rights and say that I volunteer for Exfabula, you can get that information on our page for the volunteer orientation that's going to happen on Tuesday, May 22nd.
Boy, all in one breath. That's really good.
Yes, but definitely all story-related information is going to be at our exfabula.org. And we will not be stopping with our radio shows this summer. We're going to keep going with you guys on WWM. So
we will be here every weekend as per usual. That's for sure. Fantastic. And if you want to hear today's stories again, as I said, the entire Shakespeare Lewis story And this part of the story, too, is at WUWM.com to listen again or to share. And as Leah said, all information is at xfabula.org.
.org.
And we'll be back next week.
Fantastic. See you then.
Okay.
Xfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's coming up next.